Welcome back to The Independent with Scott Atlas and part two of my interview with Victor Davis Hanson. I want to talk a little bit about your book, The End of Everything. And this is truly a book about history, but of course it's written to be applied to today. And I'm going to quote what you wrote here. You wrote, quote, "The gullibility and indeed ignorance of contemporary governments and leaders about the intent, hatred, ruthlessness, and capability of their enemies are not surprising." What is the relevance of that? What are you trying to say with what we're looking at today in the United States and the potential, really, end of the U.S. as we know it?
Well, I looked at four examples, classical themes, a Greek city-state, and then, of course, the iconic Third Punic War and the destruction of Carthage, the storming and transformation of Constantinople into an Islamic city later called Istanbul, and then the destruction, utter destruction of Tenochtitlan, what became on its ruins Mexico City. And I asked myself, how did all these civilizations that were so proud of their millennia-long existence and they were proud of their fortifications that were indomitable, how did they so easily not just become defeated in a war, but they were annihilated, extinct, erased, their religion, their language, their dialect disappeared within 30 or 40 years of their destruction, their populations killed off or enslaved, their religions wiped out. And there was a commonality. And I looked at other examples that I didn't, you know, they're mentioned in the text, I didn't study in depth, but there was a commonality. You mentioned one. They seem to have this nostalgia or this inability to calibrate what their present strength is vis-a-vis their enemies. So in the case of the United States, if you ask the average person, who has the biggest navy in the world? Well, they would say they have no idea that the Chinese Navy now has more tonnage and ships than we do. Or who has the most sophisticated weapons? Or who spends the actual more on not just retirement and healthcare, but the actual platforms and weaponry and soldiery? China or us? Which country has the highest level of GDP debt? So if you ask all these questions, they're pretty disturbing, the answers, and yet Americans just are gliding along as if they can borrow $2 or $3 trillion a year. They can always be 55,000 short on recruitment. They can give away $1.7 trillion, cancel student debts. That $1.7 trillion would have given us enough ships to be one-third larger than China's fleet. So we're not doing that. That was one thing. Another is they keep talking about allies. The Spartans will come. They'll come up the Peloponnese. They hate Alexander as much as we do. All of our imperial subjects will turn on Cortez. They won't join him. In the case of the Carthage, the Macedonians will come to the rear of the Romans. That never happens because allies in a cost-benefit analysis ask if it's in their interest to help. So we shouldn't count on, I mean, Israel has learned that if it's strong and robust and victorious, then it has allies. And when it heeds pressures from the United States to back down or to restrain their retaliatory response, then opportunistic enemies interpret that restraint as weakness to be exploited. And that was certainly true in these cases. The other thing is they have no idea about the intentions of the invaders. They keep thinking we can reason with these people. The conquerors that erased these cities were all very educated. Alexander the Great, student of Aristotle, Scipio Aemilianus, a friend of Polybius, the historian. Mehmet had the largest library in the Islamic world. Cortez, who was a hidalgo, but he was a clerk, and he would wrote very sophisticated letters to Charles V about what he was doing. And there's this idea that because they're reasonable people, or that they look as if they're from our class, or they wouldn't do this, somehow, you know, you don't think they're going to, and it turns out that the more sophisticated and intellectual they are, the more likely they're going to plan carefully the complete destruction of your city. They're very serious about what they do, and we should never confuse intellectualism or erudition with compassion or morality, but yet people do that to their detriment. And so I tried to, there's also a lot of internal division. Should we or should we not make an offer to Mehmet if we're inside the walls? Why don't the Christians in the West come and help us? There's not enough Genovese or Venetians. Just 1,000 more and we could hold out. The Thebans, maybe we should surrender our ringleaders who caused this revolt. No, we shouldn't. Same thing in Carthage. There's not a unified population. All of those are resonant today in the United States. I think that we have an exaggerated view of our economic and military strength. We're sort of gliding on fumes. We're not united. We're discordant. We keep thinking that we have these friends in the world that I don't think we do. I can't think of any ally that would come to our aid that if it was a risky thing to do. Not one.
Yeah, I think a lot of this is, I think one of the parts that really hits me as true is the naivete of people in positions of leadership. And I think we see this is all going back to sort of, you know, Reagan's peace through strength idea. When we have naive leaders in charge in the United States, we have this, whether it's arrogance or just simply being naive and not understanding the threat, somehow the idea, like President Obama thought he was going to negotiate with Iran and convince them to take on Qasem. I think we're seeing the same thing with Russia and the whole Russia-Ukraine situation.
Yeah, it's also the discounting of not taking threats seriously. So Russia has said again and again, if you enter Mother Russia, we're going to consider tactical nuclear weapons. So now, to relieve the pressure in the southeast, they have gone into the Kursk area. And they've done very well, the Ukrainians. Although I think it's more like the Battle of the Bulge with the German counteroffensive is going to be stopped, and then it's going to ultimately hurt and debilitate the defense because they're so outnumbered. But nevertheless, that hasn't happened since World War II, that you've had a major incursion into Russian soil, and you have this dictator with 7,000 nuclear weapons who keeps saying that if they don't get out or they don't, we're going to use them. And we say he'd never do it. Just like we said Kim Jong-un would never do it. Erdogan, a month ago after the book was published, although I mentioned an earlier threat, said that he was going to send troops to Gaza or send missiles at Tel Aviv. He said he was going to send them in to Athens. He warned the Armenians after he ethnically cleansed them from Nagorno-Karabakh. He said, I have a solution for you that our grandfathers used quite successfully. That's genocide. So I went through in the epilogue and I cataloged all the threats to small numbers of people, isolated countries in bad neighborhoods, Greece, the Kurds, Armenia, Israel, where their enemies had threatened to wipe them out, and people who had nuclear weapons who threatened to wipe people out. And no one has taken it. No, we don't take it seriously. The chances are 99-1 they're not going to happen, but that was true in the cases I studied historically. Nobody thought they'd actually do it, and they weren't prepared.
And so how do you get people to be in power who don't have that naive view? Because you would think that while citizens can be naive or groups can be less or more naive, you can never have a society that is successful if the people in charge are naive.
Well, it's very hard because the person who makes the argument that we're completely safe, that our enemies wouldn't dare touch us, that we're strong, look at our grandfathers, look what they...
You could just say, don't.
Yeah, that's a reassuring status quo argument. The guy like Churchill who says, we are only making 300 airframes of Hurricanes per month or Supermarine Spitfires, and they're making 600 BF-109s, and we've got to prepare because they're going to invade or attack us. And he's a warmonger. He's trying to egg us on to a war. And that's what they thought of Churchill. And I know in the 1930s, our Navy was just completely ossified. So they had this congressman Southerner, Southern segregationist, Charles the Vinson Act, and he's Representative Vinson, he said, we've got to start arming right now because the Japanese are going, after they get done with China, they will go into the Dutch East Indies, the Philippines, Singapore. And it was only because of him that the second year of the war, we had 27 carriers on order, and they were shortly built. But that entire fleet had been designed in the late 1930s. I mean, everybody hated him for doing it. So he's taking money from TVA. He's taking money from welfare. And yet we know the medicine, but the medicine is considered worse than the disease. Right now, if you said, if we had not used that $1.7 trillion student loan, and we gave $700 billion away, that $700 billion could have built 30 aircraft carriers, 20 new submarines, and a whole fleet of frigates, and we would be larger than the Chinese. If we'd use it all, but if anybody said that, they'd say he was a warmonger, or he was trying to take it out of the mouths of poor students, and so it's very hard to do. It requires a particular leader with a lot of skills, rhetorical skills, courage, and vision. And I don't see any on that.
Or that might even require having to respond to something militarily. Because yeah. I think that we've lived, as you've said many times, we've lived for decades. We have a generation or more of people who've only seen peace and prosperity. And I think this is very different for those of us who grew up, you know, doing nuclear bomb, atomic bomb drills as elementary school students. I mean, this kind of, the world has been so peaceful.
And I think we're going to have a very brutal wake up if tomorrow Taiwan, who's been suffering a lot of Chinese overflights the last month and intrusions into their maritime waters. If we wake up and that there's an embargo around Taiwan implemented by the Chinese or an invasion, and we send one of our $14 billion carriers and a $40 billion task force of two or three submarines, three or four frigates, and we send it anywhere near the South China Sea, the coast, they have the ability at night to send probably 5,000 rockets about the size of, I don't know, a desk 6 feet long or something, right at the inches above the water, that would penetrate and blow a hole 3 or 4 feet wide at the water level of a $14 billion carrier. There's no way you could stop that. Even our naval admirals say we could not stop that. And so what would happen is American would say, okay, China, stop that, or we're going to send the Abraham Lincoln or the Ronald Reagan over in that big, huge ship, 5,000 sailors, the whole task force. And then you know what it would do? It would stop out of range, 70, 80 miles away. And the captain would say, I'm not going in there. They have controlled the water and the airspace. I can't operate because we don't have the anti-missile capability, or we don't have drone capability to stop them. And that would be a rude wake up, but that's what would happen.
Mm-hmm. And we've already... If you can relate what you're saying to the readiness of our military in general, all the things that we see in about recruiting shortfalls, it's not just the money; it's other things, and the things that you perceive as affecting the recruiting and the.
It's very dangerous because our military is in denial because they have adopted. What's happened, there's two things happening in our military now. One is the old idea that you would not be promoted unless you had been in combat or you had had a superb record hitting the target with artillery shells of your unit, or you were a naval commander that your air wing on a carrier always hit the second cable, never overshot. That's out. We're promoting officers who are creatures of Washington. They get attached to the National Security Council. They understand the Senate. They have leaves of absence to go to work on Senate committees. And they understand the milieu in Washington. And when they get into positions of power, as we saw with the testimony of the chief of naval operations, especially General Milley, chairman of the Joint Chiefs, then they become fierce advocates of what they think the power base in Washington. So we should all read Professor Kendi or Lloyd Austin, who came out of Raytheon, and Milley, who will go back into probably one of these defense contractors. They tell us that they're looking for cabals of white supremacists in the military. That's what they told us in 2022 in the summer, 21. And then we find out that in December 23, they issued a report. It's online, and they didn't find any. But in that process, 55 to 60,000 people did not sign up. Some of them were the people in 8,500 that had prior cases of COVID, but did not want the mRNA vaccination. They were drummed out. Now they're being begged to get back in. They're not joining. But when you actually look at the statistics of who that 50,000 was that did not join, it's pretty predictable. And this is what gets the Army really angry, and Navy and Air Force, because it's overwhelmingly much higher than their demographics, is white males, usually from the middle and lower classes. And why that's important is that for all the talk of diversity, when you look at the combat fatalities in Afghanistan and Iraq, you get into 70, 73, 75%, depending on the year, of that demographic dies. So to translate all that, what the military has done, they've said to the guy whose grandfather fought in Gulf War I, whose father fought in Iraq, he wants to join at 18. His great-grandfather was a Korean vet. He wants to join in the family tradition from the lower white middle classes. And they're saying, yeah, you can join, but we're going to be very careful to make sure you're not a white supremacist. And then he says, or his parents say, I'm not sending him out to Fallujah again. I'm not sending him to Helmand Province. He's not going to get on the ground in Syria. I'm sorry. And they're not joining. And that is the very group that we depend on to fight in the worst combat environments. Every time I've had a discussion with a general or an admiral on this topic, I have been fiercely denounced. They really say, no, Victor, you're sorry. It's obesity. It's drug use. It's competition. I said, those were always factors. They were always where they didn't suddenly appear now. What's happened now is that your military has demonized a particular demographic. And unfortunately for you, that's the demographic that volunteers to go to the worst places in the world to fight for us. And they're not doing it. And we don't have that type of level of combat soldier, especially under the DEI therapeutic guidelines. So I'm really worried about recruitment. I'm worried about the revolving door when we get 3- and 4-star generals and they retire and there's no cooling off period and they go into Raytheon, General Dynamics, Lockheed, et cetera, and they're hired for their expertise, but that's defined as their former subordinates who are still in the Pentagon, and especially if they're in procurement, and then they lobby them. Sometimes it's good. Sometimes it can work out good. They say, well, he really knows this weapon, and my subordinate knows it, and we have the best weapon. But sometimes it explains why, if we look at the Ukrainian-Russian war, we don't see American-type $135 million jets like the F-22. We don't see $1 billion bombers like the B-2. We see thousands of $2,000 or $3,000 drones swarming, destroying $5 million tanks. And when you look at us, we say, well, why don't we have some unmanned platforms or carriers with 10,000 drones on them? Kind of a drone carrier, maybe. Or just look at what's going on in these battles in Gaza and Ukraine. And why are we spending these multi-millions and billions on very few, very sophisticated, and very vulnerable platforms that are not, they're outdated?
You're saying there's a financial financial corruption background to some of this.
It's part of it. It's kind of like the battleship lobby of the 1930s when we should have been building carriers, you know. But battleships were so ingrained as the pride of the American fleet. They looked so impressive. And there were people who went out of the military and went to work for the shipyards. But we didn't build enough carriers quickly enough. And so from 1941 and 42, we were really in bad straits. When you look at all the battleships we built, they were beautiful and impressive, and you try to see exactly what they did to win the war versus carriers, it wasn't nearly as impressive. I mean, they shelled islands and things, but we had destroyers and cruisers and heavy cruisers to do that, but we didn't have enough carriers to the end of the war. And then we did, and they won the war.
You know, one of the things I've thought of vis-a-vis the military and ties to Washington are, it seems that, in my view anyway, we have people who are commanders in chief who are not experienced at, but still in charge of, risking people's lives in wars. And I think this is sort of a simplistic way to look at it, admittedly, but I seem to, I'm a little uncomfortable that we have people who are presidents and vice presidents, therefore commanders in chief, and they don't have the perspective of someone who served in the military. And I'm not saying we need military general as president, but what I'm bringing up is, why do we have a system where the commander in chief has not had any military experience whatsoever? And one solution, and correct me if I'm wrong, could be that among all the other seemingly arbitrary qualifications for being president, age, a specific type of citizen, why can we not have, say, 2 years of military service background at some point in their lives?
Yeah, well, we have four candidates now, and two of them were in the military. Waltz's record has been controversial, and they demonized J.D. Vance because he joined the Marines when he was 18. He served 5 years, but he was a reporter, a news journalist, but he was stationed in a combat zone, and now they're attacking them because he wasn't a combat soldier. But I was embedded once in Iraq, and then I went as an observer in a Black Hawk for 3 or 4 days to look at wartime installations. And I can tell you that when you were in Iraq, there was no front. So in other words, you could be in the green zone and be killed. You could be an important UN diplomat and being blown up on a highway that was considered safe. I can remember the second embedment. Everybody said to me when I got to the airport in Camp Victory, well, you're home free now. We haven't had an attack in so long, and get on this King aircraft and they're going to fly you. We'll see you. And they left. And then all of a sudden a rocket came right at us and hit the tarmac about 100 yards in front of us. And luckily it was a semi-dud and skipped over, and shrapnel went over our head. And the point was, that was considered one of the safest places in Iraq. So for J.D. Vance to be there and travel around, I mean, it was like being a combat soldier, whether he had to shoot or not. And yet he's being deprecated and attacked because he was a journalist.
Well,
by somebody who wasn't deployed. So yeah, I think there's something to be said that our commanders should have had some experience. And most of them, I mean, George H.W. Bush did. He was a World War II veteran. Clinton did not. George W. Bush, they were made fun of him because they said he got a special exemption, but he flew a very dangerous aircraft, the F-102. It was prone to wrecks. It was very high-powered. It was unstable. And yet he was a pilot in the Texas National Guard. Nobody really pointed that out. And then, of course, Obama did not serve, and then Trump did not serve, and the president this time, either one will not serve. I don't know, we want to formalize that.
I'm just putting that up as a sort of an idea that, you know, I think it's a very, very, very serious responsibility to say, we are going to send U.S. soldiers, young people, our children, in. And to have that, I'm uneasy personally with having that decision be made by someone who simply does not have the perspective, because they
have
never
served. I think we've all learned that an optional military ground engagement in the Middle East is not going to work. And you can define that not going to work anyway. You're not going to be able to create democracy there. You're not going to be able to be liked. Any type of Hearts and Minds campaign will be resented as intrusion or colonialism. It just doesn't work.
Right.
We've learned that in Libya. We've learned that in Syria. We've learned that in Iraq. We've learned that in Afghanistan. And maybe you can have a Jacksonian punitive policy like Trump did, Soleimani, Baghdadi, ISIS from the air. But the idea you're going to take American kids and put them into those situations when there's no clear pathway to a decisive victory is not tolerable anymore. American people, as we know, won't stand for it.
Right.
And so
you're predicting that sort of the age of the neocon, where there's establishing democracy with force, is not going to happen again. It's sort of over.
Well, everything is cyclical. That was a reaction to the Clinton administration not replying to bin Laden's provocations, attacks on embassies, the blowing up of the Marines under Reagan, and this constant attack in which we either didn't reply or we didn't reply sufficiently. But then 9/11 was such of a magnitude more killed than in Pearl Harbor. Then the idea was, well, we've always just, you know, sent a cruise missile, I think George W. Bush, after a camel or something. So this time, we're going to do it right. We're going to go in there and destroy that radical Islamic government, plant ourselves there, and create conditions where it'll never have to worry about it again. And maybe for the first 2 or 3 years in Afghanistan and Iraq, it started to work. But then people realized that the amount of money, time, engagement, and the benefits received just weren't worth it. And I was somebody who supported the Iraq War, and I came to the conclusion that the United States is not cohesive enough, the military is not imaginative enough, the diplomatic corps is not astute enough, and it's not going to work. And when I went over there, I came back thinking, wow, this 18-year-old kid sitting on outside on a platform of a Black Hawk at night with a 50-caliber machine gun will be the first person to get killed if we get shot at. And you talk to him, you know, when you landed between trips, and what are you doing? I had nothing to do. I was hanging around somewhere, and they told me to join the military. I like it. I said, are you scared? No, I'm not scared. That's what I got to do. And they were really unique people. And the idea we were sending all of these very brave young people over there and putting them in no-win situations, it seemed to me just a travesty. So I kind of just said, you know, I've got to come back again and see this, because if you supported this, you're kind of responsible for this type of stuff. And after
Absolutely.
I saw it and talked to people, I thought, never again am I going to support in print or anything the use of U.S. ground troops in the Middle East. It's a dead-end idea.
The tricky part is to have a country, a foreign policy that is perceived of as strong rather than projecting weakness and reluctance. I think this is where you need the right leaders. And I'm afraid that you have to look at what Russia has done over the past several presidential administrations. To me, there's an obvious correlation between Russia's behavior and their perception of a strong U.S.
Well, it was accurate, unfortunately, because they knew that if they went in under Obama, he wouldn't do anything. And if they went under Biden, after he said his reaction would be predicated on whether it was a minor or major invasion, he wouldn't do much. He first thing he did was suspended military aid to Ukraine and blamed Trump. And the thing about Trump was he understood one central truth. He was unpredictable. And
right.
He did not want to get engaged. And people knew he didn't want to get engaged on the ground. You'd think that would make him take advantage of him. But on the other hand, when they came to him and said, get out of the Iran deal, he said, fine. Embargo Iran, yeah, fine. Declare the Houthis terrorists, yeah, fine. Cut off Hamas, yeah, fine. Move the embassy to, yeah, fine. And at each case, he said, what's the problem with it? It's logical. And I remember when they were going to, said, can you tell the Israelis they have the Golan Heights in perpetuity? And he said, well, don't they? Who's going to take it from them? So why not? And when they asked him about Baghdadi, they said, did he kill Americans? Yes. Get rid of him. Did Soleimani kill Americans? Yes. Hundreds of them, and get rid of him. But then he didn't go the next level. He didn't get in a war with Iraq. He didn't get a war with Iran. He didn't you know, get bogged down. And that was pretty amazing, that record of restoring Jacksonian deterrence without losing American soldiers. And yet he did such a good job that when Sullivan came, he was boasting on the eve of October 7th that the Mideast portfolio was his quietest.
Right.
And it turned out to be a disaster because they projected, as you said, they just projected complacency and weakness, and they were exploited. So,
I'm going to finish with this question. What do you perceive the international sort of military strategic position of the United States is in a Kamala Harris administration?
Well, first of all, it's hard to predict because she's in a 80-day transformational but abbreviated cycle. I mean, she's renounced her opposition to fracking. She's renounced her open borders policy. So we don't know what she's going to do, but we do know that this 80-day chameleon-like agenda is finite. She'll go back to where she was. If she wins or loses, if she loses, people forget she's still vice president for 3 months, and she'll go back to her left wing. If she wins, she'll be even harder. And what does that mean as far as defense? I would imagine she would cut the defense budget more. We would see more DEI and woke policies in the military. It's kind of like a social program rather than a military striking arm. I would imagine we would be overt and distancing ourselves from Israel. She seems to be much more pro-Hamas than even Biden is. She would allow Iran to be very powerful, it would become nuclear very quickly. And I think Russia would assume that the United States, I think it would be the worst of both worlds. I think she would be forced to keep supplying Russia, but if they did anything and frightened her or they said they were going to retaliate, she would fold. And I think they would challenge her, just like Khrushchev. One of the first things Khrushchev did was challenge Kennedy in Vienna. And when Kennedy backed down, the first thing he did after that is he tried to put nuclear missiles in Cuba. Kennedy said, he just tore me apart in Vienna, or Geneva or Vienna, one of the two. So it was kind of like what they do, Scott. You remember we had Blinken and Sullivan in Anchorage in March? And the Chinese met them in Anchorage, Alaska. They just dressed them down. You're imperialist. You're racist. You people have a history of discrimination against poor Chinese. You should be ashamed. And they just sat there, sphinx.
Yeah.
And they should have walked out in 2 seconds. So I'm worried about it. It'll be a bad foreign policy. It'd be kind of like Obama on steroids. Obama's apology tour, you know, and
very concerning. You know, I have to say I think it's just an overt projection of American weakness, and I think we all know where that leads. That's not
we saw it with Obama. He did that, and almost immediately there was Syria, there was a war in Syria, and then people started to get bold with Israel, and then Iran started to get on its hind legs, and then Putin eventually went into the Donbass and Crimea.
We'll see what happens. We can't predict much of anything accurately these days, but we'll see. Great talking to you, Victor.
Okay.
And we'll come back next time and talk about the elections.
Yep. Okay, Scott, take care.
Thank you. Thanks for listening to The Independent with Scott Atlas and my interview today with Victor Davis Hanson. If you want to check out more about Victor, go to his website, victorhanson.com, his podcast, The Victor Hanson Show, and don't forget, subscribe to this show on YouTube, Spotify, Apple, Google, and anywhere else you're listening to podcasts today, and I'll see you next time.